voices of resistance.
Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
Don't you know we're gonna have a solartopia, solartopia, solartopia. Don't you know we're gonna have a solartopia all over God's green world?
Well, we bit that apple and the garden was lost, and so we had to work to pay the cost. And so we went digging into the ground and started to burn many things we found. But
oh, yeah. Don't you know we're gonna have a solartopia.
That's the Dynamite. Dara Williams singing with Pete Seeger and David Burns, who wrote the words to that Solartopia song, except for the word Solartopia itself, which I wrote. I am Harvey Sluggo Wasserman, back with you for another hour here at the Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show here at PRN.FM. Thanks so much to the crew in New York. We're going to explore the nuclear power disaster yet again today with an incredibly new incarnation, which I can barely describe without starting to throw things. So I'm going to let Tim Judson do it. We got Tim Judson from the Nuclear Information Resource Service. Tim, are you with us?
I am, Harvey. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Lorna Salzman. Lorna, longtime stalwart of Friends of the Earth. Are you with us, Lorna?
Yeah, I'm with you, but I can barely hear you.
Yeah, it happens sometimes, but we can hear you. So I will talk, but don't be self-conscious. Just go ahead.
It's very hard. I can't I hope I can understand you.
Okay. And Paul Gunter, Paul, you with us from the Beyond Nuclear?
No news, Harvey.
You can't make it louder on your end?
We can't. You can hear me enough that we can hear you when you speak. And I'm not. What I say is not all important, but what you say is what's important.
So that's true, but I have to understand what you're asking me or saying.
Well,
so try to speak up and slowly and clearly. No, really, you're very good.
I will indeed. Tim Judson's going to start us today. Tim, you're from the Nuclear Information Resource Service, and you have to report on the latest outrageous push by the nuclear power industry to get a federal bailout. Do you want to tell us about it?
No, I haven't read it. It wasn't attached when you sent the email, so I don't know.
No, Tim Judson is going to talk about it.
I got the gist of it. But,
Tim Judson, do you want to start with us?
I can't comment, intelligently on it.
Go right ahead. Tracking over the last several years, the nuclear industry.
It's not going to work out. I can't hear what you're saying.
All right, Lorna, then just hang up and we'll have you on another show another time.
Yes, why don't we do that? Stay in touch, all right?
Thank you, Lorna. Take care.
Okay, thanks. Bye.
Okay, Tim Judson from the Nuclear Information Resource Service. Tell us what's going on with this outrageous bailout on Capitol Hill of the nuclear power industry, and then we'll have Paul Gunter jump in with you.
Yeah, so we have been tracking all of the multitudinous efforts of the nuclear industry to get more and more public subsidies and bailouts over the last several years. And, we found out about another one a few weeks ago where the nuclear industry is trying to get a federal subsidy now through the tax code to cash in on investment tax credits that have been proposed in a bill that was introduced earlier this year that was going nowhere. And now essentially under the cover of, a tax, what they call a tax extenders bill, which is essentially, a piece of, legislation that is, that at least, moves the federal taxation powers forward. Exelon is trying to get that nuclear bailout bill included in this, under cover of the legislative, sort of murky legislative process. included in this tax extenders bill, which would essentially give almost every nuclear reactor in the country a 30% tax rebate on their what they call investments in in capital, maintenance investments, and also purchasing nuclear fuel for their reactors. This would, by our estimates from a report that we commissioned from an economist, or the Friends of the Earth commissioned from an economist, amount to about $23 billion over the next 10 years. So about $2.3 billion a year in subsidies for old reactors that essentially are tax credits that are usually given to new energy sources like wind and solar that are industries that we're trying to encourage and grow. Innovative energy sources that we need to decarbonize our economy, and to develop new industries. They want to give $23 billion over the next 10 years to old nuclear power plants that are going to be closing down. Over the next 10 to 15 years, it's incredibly wasteful. It would actually, just like all the bailouts that we've been fighting at the state level, would be a massive diversion of money and time and resources away from developing renewables towards essentially supporting the dirty energy status quo.
How is this money going to be given? I mean, is it just going to be they're going to get checks? What's the distribution mechanism for this $23 billion to the nuclear utility?
Well, I mean, I'm sure that your listeners have heard about the outrageous way in which Amazon, which makes billions and billions of dollars in profits a year and gets away with paying no taxes. They do that through essentially their tax returns, where they take advantage of various tax exemptions and federal subsidy programs to reduce the amount of taxes that they owe. And sometimes they even get like Apple and Amazon have gotten rebates from the taxpayers at the end of the year, to pad their bottom lines. This would work the same way. So Exelon, when it files its taxes each year, would tell the IRS how much money it invested in fuel and maintenance expenses for its old reactors, and they would then take a credit against the taxes that they owe the federal government at the end of the year. Nationwide across the industry would be estimated to be at least $2.3 billion a year.
Paul Gunter, you want to jump in on this? Paul Gunter from Beyond Nuclear?
Right. Well, it's, as Tim points out, I just want to reiterate that these tax incentives for investment and production credits are primarily historically reserved for incentivizing new and innovative technologies. So this would certainly and has applied to accelerating the deployment of reliable, renewable solar, wind, particularly for incentivizing projects like offshore wind turbine farms that are recognized as probably enough wind out there on coastal wind farms that could provide enough energy for the entire nation. Particularly we're really rich in that resource here in North America. But Sluggo, what's even more alarming, nuclear industry and its champions are framing that the renewable market, because they would receive these tax credits for renewable portfolio standards, the nuclear industry is calling this a distortion of wholesale electric markets. And so they're reframing this argument that the innovation that the tax credits would provide for ramping up the deployment of renewable energy, they want that diverted. So they're talking about eliminating subsidies for renewable energy or severely undercutting them, as they just did in Ohio, and have the lion's share now go to aging nuclear power stations that are economically failing. But it's also tied to something even more concerning, is that the industry at the same time now wants to hold down the safety and security upgrade costs for things like Fukushima Daiichi disaster upgrades, building up flood protections around coastal nuclear power stations. In January of this year, despite the NRC staff and public comment basically saying that flood protections around nuclear power stations, both coastal reactors and nuclear power stations that would be facing intensified precipitation that would cause flooding from climate change, it was unanimous that these upgrades for flood protection should be required. The industry threw a back door into the commission, had those requirements, had the whole idea to require these upgrades reduced to voluntary initiatives so that the industry is able to completely avoid the upgrading to a level that could be enforceable. And that's what they've done. By removing the word requirement from the rule and making it voluntary, there's not an enforceable standard there. So they're basically able now to run reactors at higher time, for longer periods of time, shortening the times for maintenance and eliminating and reducing inspections by federal nuclear regulatory commission inspectors. Those inspections now can be done as self-inspections by the utility. The same goes for making safety grade assessments. The industry is now gaining more room to self-assess, and what they're doing is that this is all being done as a reduction of what they call regulatory burden. Safety in aging nuclear power stations is now being looked at as a burden on what the industry's financial plan is. So, this combination of basically manipulating markets to make nuclear power artificially competitive through taxpayer and ratepayer subsidies that are essentially umbilical cords. They're not really incentivizing. We're looking at something that's really more like permanent. Because, as these plants age, like your car, they're only going to require more maintenance. They should require more inspections. But instead, it's going to work against safety and reliability.
Wow. I mean, what a nightmare. Tim Judson, you want to comment on that?
Yeah, Harvey. I mean, what Paul is raising is really important because, we are in the midst of, an intensifying climate crisis, where we're getting more intense storms, we're getting more intense rainfalls, we're getting more flooding and severe weather events that are putting, you know, that are also increasing the risk of nuclear accidents. You know, almost every major hurricane that's hit the U.S. mainland over the last 2 years has made landfall, you know, near a nuclear reactor site. And we have a lot of nuclear power plants that are, you know, that are on the oceans. We also have nuclear reactors that have the sites have been flooded by, for instance, you know, the flooding in the Missouri River Valley this year, you know, where they're having to place sandbags all over reactor sites in order to try to keep the floodwaters from inundating the safety equipment and causing a nuclear meltdown. So climate change is both increasing the risks of nuclear accidents at the same time that the nuclear industry is seeking to take money away from the things that are actually going to be able to mitigate the effects of climate change, you know, namely, you know, renewables and energy efficiency to reduce the amount of greenhouse gas emissions that we're putting into the atmosphere that are making these things all worse. And the NRC at the same time is backing off of safety regulations that were intentionally proposed to bring the industry up to the current environmental threats to their sites. And at the same time, you know, there's actually been an initiative floating around the NRC for the last year that they are, you know, trying to move forward with to start allowing the nuclear reactor operators to regulate themselves instead of having the NRC conduct inspections and evaluate the significance of safety violations. The NRC is actually considering handing over those responsibilities to the reactor owners and the nuclear industry themselves. This is, you know, I mean, a really dangerous situation. And it's frankly really concerning that this is getting any traction at all in Congress.
Well, what would be the function of the NRC? Why would you have an NRC after they hand over the regulatory functions to the utilities themselves, Tim? I mean, what is even the pretense for then having the Nuclear Regulatory Commission?
Well, that's a really good question. Essentially what they're proposing is for the industry itself to do most of the regulatory functions and the NRC to simply sign off that the paperwork was completed.
Well, actually, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission could do advertising for the industry. I mean, that's essentially what is happening here, is that the NRC let's remember that the nuclear industry originally got its oversight from the Atomic Energy Commission. And in 1974-75, the Atomic Energy Commission was disbanded by Congress because its promotional role for nuclear power had far exceeded its regulatory function. And now we've come full circle, where the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, in fact, is more egregious in its promotion, blatant promotion, from the industry. But we've seen plenty of good initiatives come out of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission staff. I want to be clear about that. This is about the intervention of the nuclear industry lobby into the regulatory function, where they step in at the senior level, at the commission level. And much like what we are seeing now with the news around the Federal Aviation Administration and the fact that they are now defined by regulatory capture by the Boeing lobby. This is precisely what's been going on incrementally within the Nuclear Regulatory Commission for decades. but it's now stepped up to the point where this industry, the nuclear industry, is you know, so full of danger and uncertainty, and has become so precarious that the lobby effort, supported by Congress, which is both sides of the aisle are funded by the nuclear industry lobby effort, they have all intervened to essentially put the priorities of the economic and financial priorities ahead of safety margins, and turned over the function of safety assessment, safety inspection, more and more to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. We've just seen what happens with that at the Federal Aviation Administration, and the two crashes of the Boeing 737 MAX, because, again, the FAA had turned a blind eye on its oversight, so that it allowed the Boeing 737 MAX to be reliant upon a control for adjusting elevation without any backup, so that when that system failed, the cockpit couldn't even override these automated functions, because there was no override, really, and there was no backup. So this is where you go when you let a profit industry driven oversight take over the function of regulation. And
yeah,
so
it's
becoming more perilous.
We're talking with Paul Gunter of Beyond Nuclear and Tim Judson of the Nuclear Information Resource Service. There is a push on in Congress now to give $23 billion to continue the operation we have of 96 decrepit reactors. Correct me if I'm wrong, guys. 95 of these reactors are more than 30 years old, the exception, I guess, being Watts Bar. All these reactors were designed in the 1960s and 1970s. I was told before there were even computers that to use, and a lot of these reactors were designed using slide rules. And this to me is the number one danger facing human life on Earth, is the continued operation of these decrepit old reactors. 96 in the U.S., thankfully, we just shut Three Mile Island and Pilgrim, and about 430 worldwide. There are some under construction, two in the United States. I don't put much stock in the idea that the United States can be building more reactors. I mean, you get these clowns running around saying, there are going to be more nukes here, but I don't see it. What I do see is reactors like Diablo Canyon and Perry and Davis-Besse in Ohio and Indian Point in New York and all these other ancient clunkers that are on the brink of blowing up, for God's sakes. And, what we've had now in Ohio, and, of course, none of these reactors can continue to operate without major bailouts. What we have now in Ohio is incredibly egregious. The Ohio legislature has passed a billion-dollar bailout for the two reactors on Lake Erie, Davis-Besse and Perry, both of which could be exploding as we speak. And when the bailout was passed, I've done some shows on this. I mean, to me, it's the most amazing thing that's happening in the country right now, along with the impeachment, I guess, is that the opponents of the bailout, which does include the oil and gas industry, came in and filed with the state for a referendum to overturn the bailout. The state sat on the petitions for 38 days of the 90, that are allotted. And then when petition gatherers went into the field, they were physically assaulted by nuclear-powered thugs. Tim and Paul, have you heard of anything like this before?
No, this is a completely unprecedented level of, you know, of harassment and intimidation, and frankly, you know, bordering on election interference that the, you know, that the First Energy Corporation supporters in, you know, in Ohio have been engaged in to stop this referendum to repeal the bailout law. It really does, you know, verge on the type of Pinkerton activity that you saw, you know, try to bust up the labor movement back in the 30s. And not just the acts of like physical intimidation that were happening to the petitioners, but also these opposition campaigners were bribing the petitioners to not turn in the petitions that they were collecting. They were bribing them to just go home and not do the petitioning. And
they were offering them airline tickets to leave, even.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, and so the idea that you know that this can go on and not the bailout opponents not be at least given the opportunity to continue collecting signatures for a few more weeks in the face of all this interference is really dangerous, it seems to me, in the context of the way that corporations can use their influence in the policymaking process and the electoral process.
It's shocking. Paul, have you ever heard of anything like this?
The level of extortion and bribery and corruption, I think, is becoming more and more apparent, more and more blatant, but it all speaks to the fact that nuclear power has never been conducive to democratic process. I mean, the fact that, Harvey, if you and I were, we cut our organizing teeth on the construction of the Seabrook Nuclear Power Station in New Hampshire. And I'm sure you will recall that in the acquisition of the exclusion zone around the construction site of the Seabrook Nuclear Power Station in the late 60s, early 70s, when people would refuse to turn over their land, their barns, their homes to the construction firm, the public utility that mysteriously, like Tony Santasucci's barn burned down. But the fact that these kinds of tactics have not been unheard of, and even more egregious. But it's the fact that nuclear power is antithetical to democratic process. I mean, the fact that they can build these things and then declare a 50-mile emergency planning zone around the nuclear power station, that they built on a site that was bribed in a community where the plant was constructed, you know, by the operating utility, better police stations, better roads, more bridges. All this was promised for the immediate area, but the potential disastrous effects could extend out across like a 100-mile diameter around that plant. And clearly, none of the protection, none of those incentive benefits were provided to those communities at risk. This is a product of the fact that this is an incredibly powerful lobby that is essentially wedded to, and from the very beginning, was the intent was to build nuclear power stations to co-generate electricity from the heat of a process that was to provide nuclear weapons material. This was the original Atomic Energy Commission's white paper that was proposed to companies like Detroit Edison, Westinghouse, Union Carbide, and others, that, hey, you can help build U.S. national security by participating with the U.S. government to make plutonium, and in the process of making nuclear weapons material, you can take that byproduct steam and make electricity that's too cheap to meter. And this is the outcome.
Well, you know, we're in what I consider to be a global crisis. I'm sure you guys, too, also feel that way. I don't see any new nuclear plants being built in the United States. You hear these clowns like Michael, whatever his name is, and others talking about nuclear power being emission-free, when we all know that nuclear power emits heat, emits radiation, they emit carbon, for God's sakes. And now they're trying to sell these reactors as a solution to climate change, or global warming, or climate chaos, whatever you want to call it, or global weirding. And these reactors make everything worse, and they're getting no closer to being able to pay for themselves than they ever were. But what I find really terrifying now is this fascist assault in Ohio. Now, the situation is that the petitioners have gone to the federal court to ask for an extension of time. As best we hear, they gathered around 220,000 signatures, even amidst all the stormtroopers that were ganging up on them. But 265,000 are needed, and to get to 265, you really got to get 400 or 500. And the petitioners went to the federal court and asked for an extra 38 days to gather signatures because the state sat on the petitions, and the judge referred the case to the Ohio Supreme Court. And we're now waiting to hear from the Ohio Supreme Court. We're also contemplating holding hearings in Columbus to get testimony from people who were attacked and who were bribed on these signatures. Now, this to me is, you know, a core issue of our democracy. If they get away with this, they've basically successfully killed the entire referendum process, which is, you know, at the heart of our American democracy. And of course, it's so fitting that it would come with the with nuclear power at stake, and of course with money for nuclear power, since these reactors cannot pay for themselves. Tim Judson, can you give us some kind of prediction about what you think is going to be happening now with the 96 reactors that are left in the United States? I assume they're all going to be hands out to the states and the feds for more money. Do you see any on the near term that are likely to shut?
Well, there are still about six reactors that are scheduled to close over the next several years. I mean, you've got the Indian Point reactors in New York that are going to be closing, one by one, and next year and the year after. You've got the Duane Arnold reactor in Iowa that's scheduled to close next year. The Palisades reactor in Michigan scheduled to close in 2022. And then the Diablo Canyon reactors in California that are going to be closing in 2024 and 2025 at the latest. so there are several more reactors that are closing. You know, a number of these are because, you know, their economics are just terrible. You know, notably Duane Arnold and Palisades. You know, those reactors are just, you know, their operators are, you know, recognize that they're just not economically fit to operate any longer. You know, it's possible that the First Energy's reactors, you know, in Pennsylvania, Beaver Valley 1 and 2, are going to close in 2021, as they're currently scheduled to do, because they've not gotten a bailout from the state of Pennsylvania. So that's eight reactors right there. You know, there's, you know, the you know, what's just not clear, because the industry operates with such a low degree of transparency, is, you know, how much financial trouble other reactors are in across the country. You know, the industry, you know, is facing, as we've been talking about, you know, rising costs for maintaining these really old reactors. You know, it's, I think it's almost half of the reactors in the country, operating today are over 40 years old. They were originally licensed to operate for 40 years on the basis that, you know, that's as long as they could, you know, as long as the Atomic Energy Commission imagined that they would be safely able to operate. You know, now we're talking about, you know, over half the reactors are past that age, and almost another half are getting close to it. You know, the industry is facing, you know, real economic uncertainty. And, you know, who knows, you know, how many more reactors, you know, could be closing in the next few years. The industry is keeping up this public relations front, you know, that it's still a strong and viable industry, you know, and if it only were treated more fairly by the, you know, by taxpayers and ratepayers by getting subsidies, that they'd be good for years to come. You know, I think they're getting really nervous about this. You know, one of the things that we saw happen, one of the signs of this that we saw happen last year or year before, was that two of the major companies in the nuclear industry left the Nuclear Trade Association, the Nuclear Energy Institute. And the reason that they left was because they were so concerned about the this plea for bailouts that that Exelon and First Energy were driving, you know, because Entergy and you know, and this company NextEra didn't want state utility regulators to know that the nuclear power was getting so uneconomical and so expensive. I mean, half the reactors in the country are still operated by, you know, by state regulated utility companies, and those companies, you know, basically, you know, just tell utility commissions, you know, what their, you know, what the cost of their business is, and they're guaranteed the right to collect all that money from ratepayers, plus a profit margin. And if state regulators, you know, start to get the picture that that these reactors are becoming uneconomically expensive, and the ratepayers could save money by, you know, by developing, you know, solar and wind power instead, the nuclear industry is really concerned that the jig may be up, and, you know, and I think if that happens, you could see, you know, some of these reactors that have been protected by state regulations so far, economically protected by state regulations so far, you know, start to close as well.
Paul Gunter, what do you think?
Well, you know, I was kind of surprised that Tim essentially read my mind when he said that nuclear power, the jig is up, because that is exactly what I was thinking when he just before he said it, in reference to you know, the obvious fact that the future of nuclear power is not in new reactor construction. I mean, let's remember that the Nuclear Energy Institute and its champions on Capitol Hill, basically in the early 2000s, started talking about this nuclear renaissance. And it was a renaissance of innovation and the promise, you know, where you could build a nuclear power station for $1.5 billion. And there was a flood of orders beginning in 2006. The nuclear industry put in 28 plus applications for 28 plus units to the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission for a streamlined construction, simultaneous construction and operating license permit. So it was a, you know, essentially a drive-through licensing window. And so they started into this process. And that was 2006 when the first new orders started coming in. And where are we at today with those 26 or 28 plus reactors? Only two are under construction. They're billions of dollars over budget, years behind schedule, and the rest, where the NRC has approved this combined operating construction license, the chief financial officers would have a heart attack if their company announced that they were actually going to commence construction. The rest, these applications have been withdrawn, suspended again because of the CEO and CFO's concerns, but also the summer units 2 and 3 in South Carolina. They were the only other utility to actually commence construction. They had to abandon those two units after they essentially threatened to bankrupt the utility because they were $9 billion in the hole for a construction project that was still falling farther and farther behind. So they abandoned the project, and the ratepayers in South Carolina will now be paying for this failure. So the jig is up. However, the nuclear industry sees its bridge to the future now by extending these operating licenses, originally 40 years. 95% of these units now, the 96 units that are out there operating now, 95% of them are have received an additional 20-year extension. So now they can operate out to 60 years. Duke Power on the eastern coast and southeast United States, they have just now put the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission on notice that they're going to put an application to extend the operating license of their entire fleet, that's 11 units, out to 80 years.
I know, it's insane.
We've got six units that are currently making this application for what they call subsequent license renewal or second license renewal so that they can operate from 60 to 80. And now that's going to get bumped up to a total of 17 units are now looking to operate out to 80 years. And, you know, Harvey, this is not really so much about actually operating these dust bins out into the distant future as it is concocting a financial plan for capitalizing the immense costs that they're going to run into as aging starts causing more dangerous cracking, corrosion, embrittlement. We start finding out that hundreds of miles of electrical cable buried in these reactors that you can't really inspect or maintain. It's time's going to come due. So they're going to use these expansive license extensions to raise capital for these extraordinary capital costs that are coming out of these aging facilities.
Unbelievable. You know, it's just to hear this litany and to have seen the
the Chernobyl series and to have been to Three Mile Island and seen what radiation has done to people, and then to be living in the midst of one of the great technological revolutions in all of human history. I mean, solar and wind power are just booming ahead. Battery technology is booming ahead. LED efficiency is just, you know, going by leaps and bounds. And here you have this dinosaur industry that with the capability of wiping out entire, you know, 100-mile, square-mile patches of the Earth's ecosystems, just gouging the public, it's staggering to me. One thing, Tim, you mentioned the reactors that are scheduled to shut, Beaver Valley, Indian Point, Palisades, Diablo Canyon. How confident are you that these reactors will in fact shut, as opposed to having utilities come in and do dirty deals and get them to continue to operate even into their 40s and 50s?
Well, I think of the reactors that I mentioned, you know, almost all those closures are pretty definite. The one that I think sticks out as, you know, as potentially could be reversed, is Beaver Valley in Pennsylvania. And, because First Energy is of course still pursuing, a bailout in Pennsylvania and also Exelon, which is the other company that owns reactors in Pennsylvania, is also, seeking a bailout there. It's proved to be very controversial in Pennsylvania, in part because you have a state government that is still very much in love with coal and natural gas, and the coal and natural gas industries see these nuclear bailouts as a real threat to their own businesses. So the bailout didn't get approved in Pennsylvania this year, and that's ultimately why Exelon decided to close Three Mile Island Unit 1. But the politics of these things have proven to be pretty crazy in these crazy times that we live in. And so I think, if politically it became more feasible to get a bailout through Pennsylvania in the next year or two, you could potentially see Beaver Valley stay open. But I think Indian Point, the governor of New York, is very committed to that plant closing. Energy really doesn't want to continue operating it. With Diablo Canyon, they've already signed this. The state has already signed off on funding a just transition plan for the workers in the local community around that plant to enable it to close. And what's also really important, I think, and this gets back to your previous question about how many more reactors could be closing in the next several years. You know, Diablo Canyon, I think, is sort of, the Rosetta Stone for how this could all go. Because one of the reasons that PG&E, which of course, as we've been seeing with the wildfires and their lack of responsibility and the blackouts in California, is not a great corporate citizen. One of the reasons that PG&E decided to settle with the environmental groups and to close Diablo Canyon is actually because it's going to be necessary to phase out a lot of, most if not all reactors, in order to meet our climate goals. California has, a big, robust renewable energy standard. They have a goal of getting to 50% renewable energy by 2030. And as PG&E was looking, at its forward planning and what things were going to be like, it realized that, with all the solar power coming online in California, especially, getting to 50% renewables, by the time, the mid-2020s rolled around, if Diablo Canyon was still online, there were going to be real problems with managing the reliability of the grid. And there were going to be problems with too much electricity being online if Diablo Canyon was pumping out 2,000 megawatts of electricity 24/7. And it was actually going to be better for ratepayers. It was going to be better for reliability. And it was going to be necessary to develop renewable energy at the levels that we need to for Diablo Canyon to shut down. And that's, I think, really going to be the story, with other states around the country, is, as we start to really get committed to addressing climate change and to building up renewable energy, The idea of having, 50% nuclear electricity in Illinois is going to become a real problem, and it's going to become a real obstacle. And so it's going to become necessary for, to start phasing out reactors in order to address climate change.
And Harvey,
well, we're going to have
wild card.
Go ahead, Paul.
Go ahead. Yeah, I was just going to say, Sluggo, the wild card is at least one of the wild cards is really how rapid the adverse consequences of climate change are going to materialize. I mean, the climate crisis is no longer something in the future. We're seeing the consequence now, and how much worse it gets, how quickly it gets worse is yet to be determined. But, just take the example of flooding and nuclear power plants. The most recent studies are from inspections that were post-Fukushima. As you recall, Fukushima was caused by extreme flooding from the tsunami. But it doesn't necessarily, it's not just tsunamis that we're worried about. Here in the United States, as a result of reevaluating the flooding threat for U.S. reactors post-Fukushima, the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission discovered that 54 units here in the United States were not designed to reliably manage the flood risk for their particular area. And that included rivers as well as lakes and coastal regions. 53 units were not constructed to withstand their current risk from extreme precipitation events. 19 units were not designed for expected maximum storm surge from coastal storms. Now, these are what they call design basis events without factoring in climate change. I mean, in fact, Harvey, this is stunning, but the Turkey Point Nuclear Power Station south of Miami, down there in the flat coastal lands of Florida, they just got the green light for extending a 60 to 80 year license extension for Turkey Point without having to consider the effects of climate change on the systems and structures and components related to safety at the Turkey Point nuclear power plant. It's explicit that the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, in extending these licenses around the issue of climate change and flooding, is ignoring the future impacts of well-established, reliable science that the rising seawater is coming. And they have extended, what they call a generic environmental impact statement, meaning that they did not do an environmental impact statement for Turkey Point, those Turkey Point plants, specific to the fact that they're seated at 20 feet above sea level, and that they excluded the consideration of climate crisis on safe operations. I mean, that's how desperate this whole situation has become.
It's unbelievable. It's just, I'm staggered when I hear this stuff and terrified. And once again, we're almost out of time, and we've barely scratched the surface. The only good news is that renewables, efficiency, and battery technology are booming ahead. And, who thought that we would become free marketeers? I would advocate an end to all subsidies for all power sources, including, of course, starting with the fact that nuclear power reactors can't get private insurance. Tim Judson, you want to tell people how to get a hold of you? Tim, are you still with us? Tim Judson?
Yeah, sorry. Yeah, Harvey, thanks for the plug. Well, people can reach our organization, Nuclear Information and Resource Service, at our website, www.nirs.org.
And Paul Gunter?
Yeah, you can reach us through our website at beyondnuclear.org.
And I'm going to just say a prayer with you two guys and everybody else listening in that we get these reactors shut before the next one explodes. I mean, I was at Three Mile Island less than a year after the accident. I never want to have another experience like that, interviewing people dying across the kitchen table from me, seeing, piles of dead animals. I was in Kiev 10 years after the accident at Chernobyl. I talked to people who were liquidators at Chernobyl. I never want to do that again. I was in Japan before Fukushima, where we desperately asked that they not build nuclear reactors in earthquake zones surrounded by tsunamis. We have 96 reactors in this country. None of them can be justified economically. All of them need to shut. You guys are working on it. We're all working on it. Let's hope we get there before the next one blows up. And because this country cannot afford a major accident. Thank you, crew in New York. Thank you, Tim and Paul. We'll see you next week in a nuclear-free Solartopia.
What we conceived. Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.